Welcome to Prostate Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. We gathered community-based urologists Dr. Richard Davey, Dr. Alan Nieder, Dr. Michael Simon, and Dr. Benjamin Tripp to present de-identified cases from their practices to our faculty of Dr. Judd Moll and Dr. Dan Petrelak. Later on in this program, I interview Dr. Moll and Dr. Petrelak, but to begin, Dr. Nieder presents one of the most common dilemmas in decision-making after radical prostatectomy, consideration of radiation therapy for a positive surgical margin.
This was a 62-year-old, otherwise healthy gentleman, pretty robust guy, who came to see me after he'd already been diagnosed with clinical stage T1C prostate cancer. He had had a single screening PSA that was 5, and he had undergone a biopsy that demonstrated a Gleason 3 plus 4, approximately 20% of the cores. Relatively sophisticated patient. Him and his wife are obviously very motivated people. They had sort of seen a couple of different doctors. They'd seen an outside urologist. They had been for an evaluation for radiotherapy. They ultimately came to me, and when they came to me, they had essentially made up their mind that they were interested in a radical prostatectomy. Though we reviewed all his parameters and we had a long discussion about the risks and benefits of all the different treatment modalities, they had essentially made up their mind what they wanted to do.
Can you talk a little bit more about what went into that decision and also why they decided to come to you as the second urologist?
Sort of a manual laborer kind of guy, but they had just come to the decision they wanted the cancer removed. I recall they said they didn't want to mess around. They just wanted to have it out. And ultimately, that was their decision. And I agreed with it. I thought, based on the parameters that we looked at, that I thought he was a reasonable candidate. He was obviously otherwise healthy. He had no other comorbidities. He was in good shape. And so we went ahead. We proceeded with prostatectomy.
You had also told me, I think, that cryotherapy had been raised as an option to them.
Yeah, somebody had talked to them. I think their original doctor had recommended cryotherapy to him. And, you know, he asked me briefly about it. My sort of basic feeling is it's not a great treatment modality, or wouldn't really be my first line treatment modality for an otherwise healthy, relatively young guy, let's say not in a salvage setting or something like that. So they didn't get a great feel from the doctor who had recommended it, and they sort of decided not to do it. And I wholeheartedly agreed with them that I didn't think it was truly a great option for them.
So can you talk about what was seen surgically and pathologically?
Surgically, he did fine, was actually out of the hospital in about 24 hours. He went home with his Foley catheter, took it out in a week. And when he came back to see me, we reviewed his pathology. And he had PT2B, so it was all organ confined, but it was Gleason 4 plus 3, again, Gleason 7, but the volume was a little higher. It's about 40 to 50% prostate was involved with cancer. But the real issue, I guess, for me that we ended up speaking a lot about was that he did have a focal positive margin at the apex anteriorly, and we ended up having a long discussion about what's really the best option for him at this point, or does anything need to be done in an adjuvant setting.
Judd, can you comment on this?
Right off the bat, I would have agreed, very reasonable treatment choice, 62, healthy man, T1C, PSA 5, does have intermediate risk by the nature of the Gleason 3 plus 4 equals 7, so he would go into the D'Amico intermediate risk category. Cryo, I agree 100% with your comments. The biggest disadvantage that I see to cryotherapy right now is that to do cryo well, you have to create the entire ice ball that freezes a neurovascular bundle, so there would be a high chance of impotence. But focal cryotherapy, which some people are starting to do clinical trials on, is totally experimental and totally investigational and certainly would be not the standard for a 62-year-old guy like this. So I agree 100% with you there. It gets to the crux of the matter, and he had pathologic T2B on the final pathology report with a focal positive margin. The uncomfortable issue to talk about here is that is the issue between iatrogenic positive margins and a real positive margin due to locally extensive disease. And every urologist who does enough of these operations faces this from time to time. The question is that was there some technical issue that caused that to be a positive margin that could have been prevented had we, A, not done a nerve sparing or done some kind of slight change in our technical capabilities to avoid that positive margin. Now, the reality of it is that when the pathology report came back, the pathologist said the gland had about 40 to 50% involvement with cancer. Well, that's fairly high volume of cancer, and that would suggest to me that you're dealing with a real positive margin that's due to disease, but not due to a technical, quote-unquote, misadventure. Nevertheless, the pathologist who read it was not willing to call it T3 disease. We're off the hook to some extent. If a guy has true extracapsular extension and the pathologist says it's PT3 disease with a positive margin, well, then a lot of times we can say, well, it was God's will. It was the disease that was more extensive. But where it really becomes tough is counseling a patient and knowing how to counsel a patient when it's technically organ-confined disease and you have this positive margin. My feeling is that most of these times, the urologist and the surgeon did everything that was appropriate, everything that was in his or her power to get outstanding outcomes. It's just that the patient had some cancer cells touching the edge. Now, from a practical standpoint, if this was just a focal positive margin, I think the key thing in this case is having the urologist try to look at the case with the pathologist, try to take the time to look at it under the microscope, or at least get the pathologist to quantitate. Was just a few cells touching the margin, maybe a millimeter, versus a broad-based positive margin. If it was just a true focal positive margin, I would probably observe the individual. But if it was a quote-unquote real positive margin with a broad base on it, then you might be leaning more towards adjuvant radiotherapy.
Do we know anything more about the pathology?
It was, I think, truly a focal positive margin. When we looked at it, they really thought it was confined to the prostate, and there's just one area sort of at the anterior edge of the apex where you see cells at the border. And, you know, a lot of that, I agree with you completely, is you think potentially iatrogenic or related to the technique of taking down the apex and getting a good urethral length and stump. Because obviously, while we want to maximize this gentleman's cure during the case, we're always very concerned about what can we do to prevent global incontinence and, you know, whether we're really carefully dissecting the anterior aspect of the apex of the prostate off the urethra. And that, I think, is where we typically do end up seeing some of these margins that end up being positive.
One key point is that it was an apical positive margin, and the research has clearly shown that that's the most difficult area for the pathologist to read. And generally, an isolated apical positive margin, especially if it's focal, has been shown not to really have any negative prognostic influence. So again, if it's truly an apical positive margin, I can really feel comfortable talking to those patients and trying to draw them a picture and trying to explain how it's so difficult for the pathologist to read and it's probably an artifact. If it was a posterior lateral margin in the area of the neurovascular bundle, then we as urologists, I think, can do a little bit bigger dance as far as how we articulate that to the patient, because in that area, it's easier to read. It's more questionable whether it's iatrogenic versus real, and so it's a difficult challenge there.
Judge, just bottom line, based on what you've heard, what do you think your recommendation would likely be?
Bottom line is observe this patient, do a PSA level every 3 months for the first year, and then 6 months for the next 2 years, and then annually thereafter. And if the PSA stays undetectable, leave them alone.
Dan, can you review the evolution of clinical trial data looking at post-prostatectomy, radiation therapy, particularly some of the studies that have come out in the last couple of years?
The most recent study that's been discussed is the one that was performed in the Southwest Oncology Group, where patients were randomized to immediate versus deferred radiation therapy post-prostatectomy. And there was an improvement in disease-free survival, but not overall survival, in that particular study. The problem with the study is that the event rate in the control arm was a lot less frequent than originally anticipated. So it may be that with further follow-up and further time, we'll see a survival benefit in favor of the postoperative radiation therapy.
Dr. Simon, I know recently you published a paper based on your experience at the University of Miami with Mark Soloway looking at this. What did you find?
That paper was published recently. It was approximately 1,000 patients who underwent radical prostatectomy, and with average of 5-year follow-up, looking at whether positive margins led to increased recurrence rates. And yes, in general, positive margin is a bad prognostic factor as far as it is a significant variable in increasing your risk for recurrence of disease. However, the recurrence rate was still very low. In our patients, the recurrence rate with patients with positive margins during that 5-year follow-up was only 19%. So 81% had no recurrence of cancer. And therefore, if they were all radiated, you'd be radiating 81% of patients for no reason with all the added side effects of radiation. So that's basically what we found. Yes, it's a significant factor. You have to have that discussion. However, following them closely is certainly very reasonable, and you may avoid additional cost, treatments, and side effects for a majority of patients, at least in our series. I mean, it's different in every series.
Judd?
Just one comment. I think Dr. Simon's paper, which is a really good one with 1,000 patients, but it really points out that we've had a stage migration even with positive margins. So it's frustrating. Here we have now the SWOG positive margin trial, and we have the one from Europe that was presented by Bola. But they're probably out of date because those were rip-roaring positive margins, and now we have these itsy-bitsy positive margins in many cases where the recurrence rate is 19%.
Right, and in those patients, the patients who had multiple positive margins or a positive SV along with it or T3 disease or a high Gleason score, high PSA, their recurrence rates were much, much higher. So you had to take those into account as well.
I think the same can be said for the Messing study. Because of the issue of positive lymph nodes, there was probably more grossly positive lymph nodes than what we're seeing now because of the stage migration due to PSA use. I want to make just one other comment about this case. The 9921 study, the randomized chemotherapy study, allows for patients to receive postoperative radiation therapy. So this patient would be also eligible for that particular study. If he received the radiation therapy, it has to be completed prior to receiving the chemotherapy.
Interesting. Can you follow up with what happened with this patient, Dr. Nieder?
He did fine postoperatively. He recovered very well, and we had actually seen him back at 6 weeks with our first PSA, which was undetectable, which was obviously good news for him. Again, just like everybody discussed, we essentially decided just to follow him, and you know, we're going to follow his PSA closely every 3 months. He felt very comfortable with that decision.
Why don't we switch over back to a little more higher risk situation and go to Dr. Simon's patient.
Hey, this patient is a 53-year-old male with past medical history of colon cancer 5 years ago, prior to this current time period. He had a resection of a colon cancer in a descending colon, no chemotherapy or radiation, and he's been NED. In January of 05, his PSA was 7.9, had increased from 3.8 a year previously. At that point, he was sent to the urologist who performed a prostate biopsy. He had a Gleason 3 plus 4 equals 7 in 20% of the cores on the left. So there were several cores positive. And the rectal exam was consistent with a T2 tumor with a firm area on the left apex. He underwent the typical counseling. I think that the decision making is fairly straightforward for a young patient with this level of disease. He underwent a radical prostatectomy. And the pathology showed PT3, so an extracapsular extension, negative nodes, negative seminal vesicles, negative margins, and the Gleason was 4 plus 5 equals 9. For him, the decision was pretty easy as far as how to approach the cancer itself. Young guy, Gleason 7 cancer, and a significant volume of disease, and he decided on surgery fairly easily. Now, of course, the results of surgery were worse than what we anticipated preoperatively as far as the pathology is concerned.
I'm curious about the discussion that went on once you had the pathology.
You always want to give patients good news when you give them the pathology. Unfortunately, sometimes you can't, and you have to be perfectly honest with them, and you tell them that the biopsies aren't 100% accurate, and there's at least a 50% time when the pathology doesn't correlate with the biopsy as far as the volume of disease or the Gleason score. And in his case, obviously, the Gleason score portended a much worse prognosis than the biopsy. And a lot of times I do pull out nomograms in these patients because they want to know. I try to stay away from exact numbers a lot of times because patients get hung up on that, but some patients really want to know, and I think it's important to give them the honest answer for the information that we have. So a lot of times I do pull out the nomogram. I have it right on my handheld Palm Pilot, and I calculate the numbers, and I tell them every patient's different. These are based on thousands of patients. This is the best information we can give you based on your pathology. And I'll punch your numbers in, and I'll tell you exactly what it says. And in any case, for this gentleman, I told him that the options were to treat him with radiation or to follow him. And I thought the radiation was going to offer minimal benefit based on the Gleason 9. In that situation, his risk of microscopic metastatic disease is pretty high. And I thought that radiation probably would offer a very minimal benefit, but I still encouraged him to see a radiation oncologist to discuss that with them to get another opinion so that he would feel more comfortable with that kind of decision considering his age.
Judd, what kind of numbers, if he wanted specific numbers, would you have given to him, and how would you have thought through management?
everyone has their nomogram du jour, and there's a bunch of them out in the literature. I think many people would use the Catan nomograms, which are, I think, probably the most validated. We did some similar ones in the military, and I can't remember the number for Catan, but I do remember our nomogram that we had out to 7 years for a man like this. He would have had about a 15 to 16% disease-free survival. In other words, there would have been about roughly an 85% chance that at 7 years he would have already experienced a biochemical recurrence and about a 15% chance that he would still have an undetectable PSA. Now, and we're not talking about death from prostate cancer or clinical metastasis. A couple things that I just want to comment on is that even though I think this guy probably has high-risk disease, and we're going to talk about that, we have to be a little careful because we have had a stage migration and pathologists have changed the way they read pathology reports. And this guy has negative margins. And so there are cases of very low volume Gleason 9 disease. And again, based on the way some of the pathologists are getting retrained, the only pitfall here is that it's possible the pathologist called this on a very low volume of Gleason 9. So one of the key questions I would try to ask is give me a sense of how much, if this high volume Gleason 9, or was it just a small focus? How much extra capsular extension did he have? Did he truly have negative margins? What percent of the gland was involved? If he was one of those weird cases that just had very low volume Gleason 9, you could possibly make an argument to observe him. I had a very similar case. One of my old neighbors where I was growing up who I hadn't seen in years came to see me about a year ago for a radical prostatectomy from up in central Pennsylvania, down in North Carolina, and very, very similar, except he was older, but exact same situation. He was Gleason 7 at the start. He had a Gleason 9. When I first got the pathology report, I freaked out. But when I went and talked to the pathologist, we looked at it, and he just had a little bit of it. And so my patient, who was in this setting, is now 9 months out. We didn't do anything, and he still has an undetectable PSA. But again, I'm not sure if that's similar to yours. It depends on how high or low volume the Gleason 9.
It's a palpable tumor, T3. It was 20%. How would that impact your decision-making?
If it was the average T3 Gleason 9, then there's no question he's going to need something else beyond radical prostatectomy. But I just point that out. There are occasional patients now in the heavily stage-migrated era that might have a focal bad Gleason score who could be observed. I would try to get this guy on SWOG 9921, even though we have that open at Duke, and I would pushed to get this particular guy on that trial where he'd be randomized to 2 years of hormonal therapy versus 2 years of hormones plus the mitoxantrone-based chemotherapy.
Assuming he's not eligible or he doesn't want to participate, getting back to your standard of care and recommendations and all that stuff, how would you kind of go through this with him?
Well, I guess if he didn't want to go on that trial, I've heard some people argue, and I'm sure Dan can comment on this too, when they would say, well, SWOG 9921, the control arm is 2 years of hormonal therapy.
And it's MAB also.
Yeah, therefore, some people would argue that if he doesn't want to go on the trial, then at least you could give him 2 years of complete hormonal therapy as quote-unquote the standard. That may be a stretch, but I've heard people argue that point. He's only 53. I mean, maybe he had a successful nerve sparing. Certainly the guy is only 53 and probably wants to maintain his libido. This might be one where you would consider adjuvant bicalutamide. Again, high-risk PT3 disease. In the trials, those were the patients who seemed to benefit from 2 years of adjuvant Casodex.
He had nerve-sparing surgery?
Yeah, and he's potent. So you would offer him hormones immediately?
Well, the downside of offering him hormones immediately is the fact that it's Murphy's Law. Now he has the successful nerve-sparing. He's probably happy that his sexual function is returning. And so now you hit him with traditional hormonal therapy and you're going to really mess up his sexual recovery. In this case, if you did use bicalutamide monotherapy, at least he would have a better chance, I think, of continuing to rehabilitate his sexual function and maintain his libido, although it's not FDA approved. It would be off-label, whereas traditional hormonal therapy would be considered some people's standard of care.
Was he the kind of patient who was totally focused on everything he can do about the cancer or more concerned about quality of life or somewhere in between?
Somewhere in between. I mean, it's realistic. First of all, if you're dealing with hormones, two different issues. One is radiation, one is hormones. If you're dealing with radiation, there's some people that would say that maybe there's a very small potential benefit in a patient like this. I don't believe there's much. So you tell them you're going to lose your sexual function, at least 50% chance of that happening, and other effects on urination symptoms, proctitis, those types of things. So there's going to be side effects, and they're very unlikely to be any benefit. And he can make that decision for himself based on his age and what he wants. But as far as hormones is concerned, I don't think there's really any great evidence that says that early hormone therapy versus waiting till the PSA recurs till whatever number you choose is going to change his survival. So yeah, maybe you can buy him an extra year or two of good quality of life before you start hormones. And then you can talk about the discussion of Casodex versus maximum androgen blockade versus just LHRH analog at that time. But you have to present them the evidence. There's no evidence that there's improved survival by starting the hormones now. So, I mean, I think most patients would say, then why am I going to do that and get the side effects?
Dan, what are your thoughts?
This is a very, very interesting case. We had one almost identical at Columbia, where a patient who was, I think, 48 at the time, was originally diagnosed with a Gleason 6 and then at surgery at a Gleason 9. He's a very interesting individual. He insisted that we send his tumor for DNA phenotyping to be sure that the tumor was actually his. And it turned out to be actually his. So this is, you know, a typical New York executive who really wanted to be sure. This is truly a second opinion. I think that this is an excellent candidate for the SWOG study, 9921. Hormones versus hormones plus mitoxantrone chemotherapy. There's a second study that is also being opened nationally as well as internationally. That's the TaxTier study, where there's a slightly different bent to that. It's very, very similar to the SWOG study, but the question of early versus delayed therapy is being addressed. So it's either immediate hormones or chemotherapy plus hormones versus delayed hormones or chemotherapy and hormones at the time of PSA progression. We don't have an answer in the non-lymph node positive patients as to whether we should give early hormone therapy or not. The interesting thing about the Messing study is that the median PSA at which patients started hormone therapy was somewhere around 14. So we don't know whether starting the hormones at first PSA rise is the same or worse than starting the hormones immediately. And I think in a patient like this where you would like to maintain sexual function, and again, this issue of the long-term effects, chronic effects of hormones on bone mineral density, on muscle mass, that also comes into play in a 53-year-old. Again, it's difficult without the actual data to make any real conclusions.
In the TaxTier study, what kind of androgen deprivation is used?
Combined blockade.
What went into the thinking in both of these studies to use combined therapy?
The Messing trial, I think, was really the driving force of that. I think also that it was felt to be difficult to have a no-treatment arm in a high-risk study. And I think that some of the logic at that particular time was that you needed some form of treatment in the control arm, and that was felt to be hormone therapy.
Is it a more difficult discussion to talk about the SWOG 9921 study using what we now think, at least in metastatic disease, is an inferior chemotherapy to what we have available in terms of docetaxel?
I don't think it is. I think that the rate of accrual has not really changed since the publication of the TaxTier today, which I think is a very, very promising observation. But the way I explain it to my patients is that we don't know which chemotherapy in this particular setting is better. And certainly you're saving Taxotere for later if you need it, if it doesn't work. The other analogy I draw is that in colorectal cancer and breast cancer, particularly in colorectal cancer, where oral 5-FU has been given as an adjuvant, has been shown to have a survival benefit, that the same situation may be true in prostate cancer, that even though 5-FU has no survival benefit in metastatic disease, it has a survival benefit earlier, and certainly it's reasonable both morally and scientifically to continue the study.
Getting back to this concept of non-protocol therapy, Dr. Simon seems persuaded that there's no reason to initiate immediate therapy as opposed to waiting for PSA progression. In a patient who's really focused on the cancer, and I think in cancers in general, we see all a spectrum of how people respond to these kinds of situations. So in the patient who's particularly concerned about the cancer and anything they can do possible, and turns around to you and says, Doc, you know, what would you do if it were you? How would you respond, Judd?
Well, I've had a number of really high-risk patients like this in the last couple of years who fall into that setting. And if a patient is not concerned about hormonal therapy side effects and is not interested in a protocol, I have no qualms about putting them on a year or two of complete hormonal therapy adjuvantly in the immediate postoperative period. Again, I don't do it routinely, but in the setting you talk about where a patient wants something done, and again, I generally agree with Dr. Simons. If this is truly Gleason 9 disease, it probably is systemic disease. I don't see a huge role for radiation therapy here. On the other hand, it wouldn't be wrong to give radiation therapy either. But let's say the guy's already ruled out radiation and he wants something done, it wouldn't be wrong either to give him a year or two of complete hormonal therapy. The other thing to spice it up a little bit is, even though it's controversial, one could do a prostacyclin scan in this setting. Even though that test has been a little bit of a black eye, when it was FDA approved, now with three-dimensional imaging associated with it, synchronized CAT scan prostacyclin, the gurus think it's more accurate. And so it could be done. If it showed systemic disease, it might lean one more towards giving hormone therapy, although you could argue you could give hormonal therapy regardless of what the prostacyclin shows.
Judd, what goes into your thinking to use complete androgen blockade here?
Well, again, the 9921 trial does use complete hormonal therapy. I know it's extremely controversial because obviously the survival benefit comparing complete hormonal therapy to LHRH alone in traditional D2 disease is modest, probably 3-5% if you're talking about flutamide or nalutamide, and maybe some people say slightly higher survival benefit when you're talking about bicalutamide. But I tend to just be of the philosophy, if I'm dealing with earlier stage disease, to give the patient the benefit of the doubt in favor of complete blockade. I know it's controversial. I know there are other people who are experts in the field who disagree with that. About half of urologists favor complete hormonal therapy. About half of urologists favor monotherapy.
And it's interesting because the main thing that people bring up is the cost. And I was mentioning to Mark Soloway recently, prostate cancer hasn't been hit yet by the biologics. But once they come on board, the costs of MAB are going to be viewed, I think, a little bit differently. Dan, what are your thoughts about non-protocol options for this man?
Certainly, the issue of early hormone therapy is something I agree with Judd. I think it's reasonable to consider a year or two of combined blockade. I think the chemotherapy issue is somewhat more problematic because of the possibility of toxic deaths. And in the rare cases where patients have absolutely insisted on chemotherapy, I always bring that issue up, that you can potentially die from neutropenia and neutropenic sepsis. So I'm a little bit less inclined to giving patients off-protocol treatment. And again, we also don't know how this is going to affect the disease in the long term. And it's possible that there could be a detrimental effect. I don't think that's what's going to happen, because I think that the models in other solid tumors, breast, colon, and lung, where early chemotherapy all show a benefit, I'm sure it's going to show the same thing in prostate cancer. But again, we need the proof.
You know, one of the things that's kind of interesting looking at this from the outside is to see the difference in approach to what I would call adjuvant hormonal therapy based on whether the patient's treated with radiation therapy up front or surgery. In other solid tumors, we have this concept that it's not about the local therapy. And even in breast cancer, they lump together people who've had lumpectomy, mastectomy, when they look at these adjuvant trials. And yet, you have your patient who locally advanced disease gets radiation therapy and endocrine therapy as a standard for 3 years. Now a patient with probably greater risk who has a very conceptually different approach. Judd, any thoughts about the difference in terms of the paradigm there?
I think your point is well taken, that whether we can translate breast cancer to prostate, but the point is that I think a lot of us are still, by an evidence basis, we just don't have the trials with radical prostatectomy like we do with radiation. I mean, there are randomized trials that show a benefit to hormones with radiation, and most of us try to follow that evidence basis, and we just don't have that with radical prostatectomy. So the tendency among urologists, I think, is to be more reserved on using hormonal therapy when they're talking about a post-radical prostatectomy patient.
Clearly, we see this in patterns of care. Our patterns of care study shows this. And you wonder whether you guys are ever going to even get an answer to this.
I would just reiterate what you said. I'm not clearly sure why, if this patient is at high risk and he is off protocol, why he wouldn't warrant a very careful discussion about long-term androgen therapy, at least 3 years like the BOLA study, and maybe even more, like long-term hormones are given for breast cancer. And the same approach goes towards the total androgen blockade versus not the total androgen blockade. And again, with the discussion that there is some evidence that there is maybe a 6-month or 3-month or 9-month improvement in survival for a young man. And lastly, my comment would be, although a minority of patients are cured by external beam radiation therapy with a Gleason grade 9, there are definitely a minority of patients being cured by that. So therefore, if you discount that as an option, then you discount the potential 5 to 15 to 20% of people that might be cured with radiation therapy versus offering no cure whatsoever. So I would throw it back at the committee and see what maybe you would do for yourself.
That's the age-old argument with adjuvant and salvage radiation. It's that where do you draw the threshold between benefit and risk? And it's hard. That's an individual discussion between the patient and the doctor. And I think your point is well taken. I think it's probably wrong just to summarily deny radiation in that setting. But we also have to recognize that with Gleason 9 disease, the chance for a durable benefit is going to be probably lower than 20%. But some patients may choose to take that risk for a modest benefit.
Well, that's exactly what I told them, minimal benefit, and sent them to a radiation oncologist.
But I would argue with you about a modest or a minimal benefit, because if you're that 20% that are cured, it's not modest, not minimal. You've beaten the disease, and you have a long life. So you do have a small chance of cure, but you're cured. And that's my argument about it. And furthermore, I think that my experience with radiation after radical prostatectomy, although limited, has been quite well tolerated. It's not a therapy that gives them, for the most part, a lot of complications, although your point about the complication rate is true.
I think I heard you say 50% incidence of sexual dysfunction.
Say at least.
Yeah.
Is that true?
Yeah, I agree with him. We actually looked at that in CPDR where in men who had regained potency after a radical prostatectomy, but then either have adjuvant or salvage radiation, about half of them lost what they had gained post-op. For a young guy that's only 53, that is an important point, is to counsel them that your point is well taken, that he may derive benefit from radiation from a disease control standpoint, but he may lose benefit from a sexual function standpoint.
But maybe regain it with oral therapy as well, if you're aggressive about treating it as well. So maybe that 50% is not as true with additional therapies.
Final point, we were talking about what the threshold is to treat PSA-only disease. Dan, in this patient, what would it take for you to initiate endocrine therapy?
I probably would not treat him until he reached a PSA of probably 2 or 3, and again, based upon doubling time. In the low end of the spectrum, you generally see, I think, some inaccuracies and some fluctuations in PSA. And I think that if I start seeing a rapid doubling time, or if it started getting up to an absolute value of 2 to 3, somewhere in that range, I would treat him.
Is your threshold different in this situation, Judd, considering how high risk he is?
I was hoping you would not ask me to comment on this because I have no idea. But, I mean, obviously, I think we're all biased by the fact that he had Gleason 9 disease. So any jump in PSA is likely to be real. And the only reason I mention that, all the urologists have patients who had maybe a focal positive margin of Gleason 6 or even a negative positive margin, but might have had benign glands at the margin. And there are a few patients who can have a little bump in their PSA in the postoperative period who don't have a cancer recurrence. But in this guy, Gleason 9, his PSA is going up. We know what it is. In the retrospective study we did in CPDR, we found that we couldn't make any difference between a threshold of PSA of 5 and 10. In other words, if you look at just absolute PSA, early hormone therapy could be defined as starting hormones before a PSA reaches 5 or 10, and it didn't seem to make a difference in the recurrence rates after that. But again, the follow-up was short and it was not randomized. But I agree with Dan, the key would be trying to follow PSA velocity. On this case, we were arguing back and forth whether we wanted to give him 2 years of hormone right from the get-go with an undetectable PSA. So my guess is probably Dr. Simons would say, well, I didn't give him adjuvant hormone therapy, but if even his PSA, say, goes to 0.4 or 0.5 with Gleason 9 disease, you might pull the trigger quicker on this guy than you would on another guy. Don't know.
Let's continue on with Dr. Davies' case.
This is a very healthy, active 50-year-old gentleman who came in to see me for just a regular checkup about a year ago and was told that he had an abnormal DRE and he had a PSA of 0.2. On exam, he did have a slightly indurated left lobe of the prostate. And at that point, I recommended to him that we proceed with a biopsy based on his digital rectal exam. Obviously, he had a normal PSA of 0.2. Biopsy was consistent with one small core or 1% of prostate cancer Gleason 6. In private practice, and I'm sure this is not the case at the university, we tend to get bone scans and CAT scans on everyone for all reasons, and it was negative, as would be expected. So I presented him with his options. He's a professional, very active man. He's got 2 small children. They travel all over the world. It was very important for him that this disease in no way affected his lifestyle or his family. His wife was very, very concerned about it. So when they came in to see me, after I had the results, they both came in to see me. In fact, she was teary-eyed when she came in because she was so concerned about him. So at that point, I sat down and discussed with him what I thought his best option was, given the fact that he's a 50-year-old healthy male.
What exactly did you say?
I gave him all the options, including observation, although I told him that wouldn't be a very smart option for a 50-year-old guy. However, that was available to him. But that predominantly for cure, the two options that are available are some form of radiation versus a radical prostatectomy. And in a gentleman with this background, I leaned very strongly towards the radical prostatectomy. And I told him that I thought that the majority of urologists, if he were to pool 100 urologists, probably 95% of them would say to have a radical prostatectomy given this information.
Judd, what would you have said?
Well, it's a very interesting case because the thing that blew me away when I was listening to it is the PSA of 0.2.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about it. If I would have had that knowledge of a PSA of 0.2, recognizing that all of us, the digital rectal exam is somewhat subjective, unless that digital rectal exam was obviously positive, you know, I probably would have said, it feels fine. Let's come back in a year. But you can't be criticized because the guidelines clearly say that if a guy has an abnormal digital rectal exam, then the next step is transrectal ultrasound-guided prostate biopsy. So clearly I can't criticize Dr. Davey because he did what the guidelines call for. But the reality of it is a PSA of 0.2 has such a low association with prostate cancer. Now he was biopsied. He has very small volume disease.
I agree with you. The majority of rectal exams that I do, I don't feel anything. In this particular case, this gentleman happened to also be a friend of my partner. So I wanted to be absolutely sure. So I had my other partner come in and do a digital rectal exam on this patient. And he said, well, you know, there could be something there. So of course, that's when everybody throws their hands up and say, do whatever you need to do. Let's not take any chances.
It reminds me of a decade ago when General Schwarzkopf was diagnosed. Now, again, putting us back 10 years ago, Schwarzkopf came in at that time with a PSA of 1.3 and, you know, was having this digital rectal exam as part of a retirement physical. And when he eventually then was diagnosed and then feeling him, gosh, he had such a subtle questionable abnormal digital rectal exam. Our hats were off to the original urologist, or I don't even think it was a urologist. It may have been a PA or something who picked this thing up. So now 10 years later, the PSA has gone from 1.3 as something at that time that blew us away as being so normal, now to down to 0.2 that's normal. But anyway, so now we're dealing with a guy who's 50 who has a very small volume prostate cancer. A lot of people used to think that young age predicted a worse prognosis, but I think we know now in the PSA era that age alone doesn't predict worse prognosis. So just because the guy's 50 doesn't necessarily mean he's going to have more aggressive prostate cancer. And I think that you're right. Probably 90 to 95% of your current urologists would say that the guy should have a radical prostatectomy. If you talk to Laurie Klotz or you talk to Bal Carter or you talk to even Peter Carroll, if they were sitting here, they would probably be trying to teach us that we should not look at the guy at 50, but look at the guy as a guy with extremely small volume prostate cancer and offer him watchful waiting. But the reality of it is that we're all in the trenches, and with real patients, he would end up with a radical prostatectomy in my practice because he would be freaking out and wouldn't tolerate a watch and wait approach.
Was it your assessment that he could have handled a watch and wait approach emotionally?
To be honest with you, I never really thought of even offering that to him, especially with his wife there crying and saying, let's do something, this is not happening. And so to turn around and then say, well, you know, let's just wait and see what happens. It wasn't the way I was trained, and I just would never have thought about giving him that as an option unless for some reason he absolutely insisted on it.
Dan, the man wants to get an unbiased opinion from an oncologist and comes to see you.
I think you can offer him all modalities, including watchful waiting, radiation therapy, surgery. I think the practicality of this patient undergoing watchful waiting is probably nil based upon what you're saying about his family situation.
Well, what would be the point of doing watchful waiting in a 50-year-old?
Right. The other issue, too, is how true a reflection of the overall volume of disease is this biopsy. And I think it's probably pretty accurate given what his PSA is. I mean, 0.1, he's not doubling at a fast rate. So I think that watchful rating is probably a reasonable option to go forth with in this patient. But practically, I don't think it can be done.
Dr. Nieder?
I'd just make the comment that there does seem to be a dichotomy between his clinical stage and his biopsy findings, and that I guess it wouldn't be unreasonable to go ahead and do a repeat biopsy to really see if he's got higher volume clinical stage T2 disease, and that was what was driving a subtle abnormal digital rectal exam.
How many cores were
1% out of 12 cores.
Right. I guess the issue is because, as Dr. Moll was talking about with watchful waiting that, let's say, Dr. Klotz has been talking about or writing about a lot. You know, I guess it's sort of almost a misnomer, watchful waiting now versus watchful waiting 20 years ago. Historically, watchful waiting, the way I used to think about it, it was for 75-year-old men with lots of comorbidities who are likely going to die from some other disease manifestation than their prostate cancer. But when I think about a 50-year-old healthy guy with very, very low volume disease or favorable parameters, it would not be unreasonable, I think, to, let's say, rebiopsy him, and let's say he did really have truly very low volume, low-grade disease, and you could say, well, maybe the abnormal DRE was driven by something else, prostatitis or some other factor besides clearly a bulky tumor. If the patient, obviously, and family agreed to follow him and repeat a biopsy in a year, and if their volume was still the same and the Gleason score was still the same, it would be unreasonable just to keep following him like that.
But he still has a cancer, so...
But clearly not a life-threatening cancer.
Not at this point.
Not at this point, right. But potentially, if he's able to tolerate a biopsy, which most men now can do pretty easily with periprostatic nerve block, and you might be able to hold off on doing a prostatectomy or maybe radiotherapy for 5 years or something like that.
So this man asked you, what's the chance that I could go live to be 90 and never have a problem from this prostate cancer?
That's a great question. That's the dilemma. If he would live to 90, his chance of maintaining a 40-year life expectancy is completely unknown. My guess would be only about a 10 to 20% chance that the guy could make it 40 years without clinical progression and metastasis and death. But on the other hand, we don't know. This is an uncharted territory. The problem is we've opened up a Pandora's box. The patient and the family are freaking out with the C word. The reality is you may have just hit an autopsy cancer that we know from Whale Sacker's study from Detroit that at 50, there's about a 30 to 35% chance of having autopsy prostate cancer. Yet we know most of those men never die of prostate cancer. So from an academic standpoint, you may have hit autopsy prostate cancer. But from a practical standpoint, now you're dealing with a guy who knows he has cancer. His wife is freaking out with cancer. And I know as a family member, even as a physician, we aren't always rational when we hear the C word. And we went to that program a couple of years ago with the other physicians. And even though we know what prostate cancer means and doesn't mean, typically when these physicians were faced with prostate cancer themselves, many of them decompensated and threw the academic stuff out the window and basically were as scared as everybody else.
Dr. Tripp?
I have different comments and different experience. I have a very similar patient in my practice, 48 years old, highly anxious patient, had about a percent of his 12 biopsies were positive with a low PSA of under 1, which is done for an indurated prostate exam, and we're watching him, and he's highly anxious, and we had the exact same conversation, but with the different semantics on the use of autopsy cancer. That's what we were discussing, that there are these studies that show that 30% of patients of the age of 50 have cancer in them, but is that the same cancer that we're discussing? And I don't know if I agree that he is a gentleman that has cancer. Obviously, he has several glands that do have cancer, but what is the significance of it? In fact, I did exactly what Dr. Nieder suggested. I waited a year, and approximately a year ago, I did another 12 biopsies, which are completely normal. So I have 23.9 biopsies out of 24 that are completely benign with a block, and that was not an issue. And my approach is, in fact, we'll probably give one more biopsy in the next year or two, his PSA has been stable, to see exactly really where we are. In fact, does he have cancer or not? I have a completely different take on this patient.
Judd? It's interesting that Dr. Tripp brings that up because, again, I recently heard Peter Carroll speak on this topic, and apparently they, and I don't know when it's going to be organized, but the NCI wants to do a consensus panel or some type of summit to actually possibly change it and not call these cases cancer to avoid the problem that you're facing in the trenches right now, that you called it cancer and then you've opened up all the issues associated with it. Now, whether that'll ever come to pass, but I think your point is well taken. And we're in a transition period right now because Dr. Davey and most of us around this table trained in the era when we were taught prostate cancer in a 15-year-old guy is prostate cancer, no questions, you deal with it definitively. And that seems to be maybe slightly
changing. I think that's a very important point because we've become so robotic about the way we treat. You also have to remember the way you would look at this case at a university setting versus a private setting are, I think, pretty close to two different things. The majority of these patients that come in, like you said, 50-year-old, PSA is low, boom, surgery. It's just a given. Next patient. And that's the way we tend to treat. At the university, a case like this would be discussed over and over, and then different options would be given, I think. Not to say that that doesn't happen in the private sector, but I think that most of it tends to be second nature.
Speaking of university, one of the things that intrigued me about this case was the actual follow-up in terms of what happened.
Yeah, it's interesting. This gentleman, after I had given him all the options, of course, the other thing that was very important to him because he was only 50 was his sexual function. So I made a suggestion that he go see a very well-known urologist up in Maryland and get a second opinion, which he did. And the urologist up there, as Dr. Tripp mentioned, wasn't sure that this was in fact cancer. So he had his pathologist look at it and confirm that it was cancer. The urologist in Maryland recommended that he has a PSA and a rectal every 6 months and a biopsy every year. At that point, he seemed comfortable with it, and I was okay with that, but at what point do you treat this patient?
Was the wife comfortable with that?
You know, he never mentioned a word about that. After that, I only saw him, so I don't know. She never came back in with him. I'm assuming that she was.
But he seemed to be comfortable with it.
Yeah, very comfortable with it.
Judd, any closing comments on this?
I'll be very interested to know what the follow-up is. Valentine Carter has the prospective watchful waiting study at Johns Hopkins, and I don't know if that's the particular urologist he saw, but it's a great academic study to try to look at cases like this. And the biggest issue, I think, is the psychological well-being of the patient. Can he and his family accept this active surveillance approach? You know, my guess is we actually have done several studies looking at the outcome of watchful waiting when I was in the military. Now, the good news, bad news. We looked at watchful waiting in the military, but in that era, it was pretty much just catch as catch can. It wasn't a really good educational way to do it. It was just whatever the urologist decided to call watchful waiting was watchful waiting. And with that gamish, the dropout rate for guys under 70 was almost 75% at 5 years. So if that study holds, then this guy probably would have about a 25% chance of being maintained on active surveillance 5 years from now. On the other hand, if they educated him right and really counseled him properly and so forth and did a better job of prepping him for it, then maybe his fallout from it will be less.
Well, this urologist, when I questioned at what point do you do something, he said that when the PSA starts to move. How much does it need to move and what do you do next is the question.
Dan, where are we in terms of maybe biomarkers to separate out biologically important prostate cancers? You know, we see a lot in terms of genomics and proteomics. Anything coming up that might be helpful?
We're still in our infancy. I know that there are several different systems where they're trying to basically profile the entire biopsy specimen for different oncogenes. But I think we're really still in the infancy as to what these markers mean. And then, of course, once you retrospectively evaluate a marker, you need to prospectively validate it. So it's going to take a long period of time for us to really figure out how to use them.
Dr. Nieder?
I'd just like to get the other panelists' opinion on, for somebody who is young and otherwise healthy and isn't going to undergo, let's say, definitive treatment, what is the role for dietary modification or vitamins or anything like that? I mean, because there are people who are writing about this, and, you know, obviously there's nothing very definitive, but what would you tell your patient, I guess?
Well, what I tell my patients is that, I mean, there's a lot of stuff being written about and a lot of stuff on the internet, but the true evidence basis for any of it is really questionable. The only good data that I'm aware of, and it's still questionable, is the data out of San Francisco with Peter Carroll's group. They've been doing this hardcore nutritional intervention with very low-fat diet to see if it would affect PSA recurrence rates. And they present some early evidence to say that it may lengthen PSA doubling times, but that's about it. But it's a very intense, low-fat diet, very difficult for probably a lot of patients to be able to follow that.
To adhere to this type of diet is extremely difficult. And then, of course, there comes the question of compliance. Are these patients compliant with what they're eating? And I'm sure it's just like your sex life or alcohol, for that matter. You'll probably exaggerate what you're saying or underestimate it. But we do know that, at least in some retrospective studies, that those patients who are obese, the surgery is more difficult. And it may be that there are hormonal effects that go on. Testosterone levels may be lower, and that may portend a more aggressive course.
Let's go on to Dr. Nieder's case.
This is a case of an 84-year-old gentleman who is from Chicago, but essentially spends a lot of the winter down in Florida, as do a lot of our patients here. He had undergone external beam radiotherapy about 10 years prior for, as far as I can tell from the old records, Gleason 7 prostate cancer. And he had done well for a couple of years after that. He ultimately had a PSA recurrence. He was probably, I think, about 78 at that time. And he was treated with LHRH agonist. He had had a good response. Ultimately, his PSA rose again, and he was put on a total androgen blockade. Ultimately, his disease became refractory, and his PSA had gone up to about 50, as far as I can tell. He had had a bone scan that demonstrated metastases in a few areas. And the patient was recently started on docetaxel, who was the every 3-week regimen with prednisone. The oncologist who'd been following him in Chicago, they had also started him on Zometa. I think he was getting that every 3 to 4 weeks. He was otherwise a healthy guy. He didn't really have any other significant comorbidities except some mild hypertension. I actually got to treat him, or he really came to see me, because he's down in Florida trying to spend a couple of weeks to a month or two, and now he's in urinary retention. And he ultimately required a TURP, which we did, which was fine. We got him out of retention. All his chips demonstrated high-grade prostate cancer on his TUR specimen. And so that's where we are with him.
There are a few points in this case I thought would be interesting to discuss. The first, in this 84-year-old man, what's your observation been in terms of how he tolerated the taxotere?
I think he'd done relatively well. He got most of the doses up where he was in Chicago initially. And when he came down here, I think he only missed a couple of doses, or they held, obviously, so we could take him to surgery, do the TURP. But, you know, he was doing okay. I mean, he looked relatively robust, I guess. I mean, yeah, he was sort of hanging in there. He felt okay.
And has he ever had any bone pain?
I think that's what initially initiated the chemotherapy. He's obviously been continued on the LHRH agonist by his oncologist. And I think he was having some back pain where his bone scan lit up a couple areas in the lumbar and thoracic spine. That's what initiated initially the chemotherapy. He now feels relatively fine. He wasn't very happy walking around with a catheter for a good 6 weeks before, you know, we'd given him a couple of trial avoids, which he failed. And, you know, he was pretty obstructed, but we were able to get him out of retention.
Dan, what do we know about the ability of chemotherapy, and particularly the docetaxel regimens, to relieve tumor-related symptoms?
I've had some patients who have had fairly enlarged prostates and urinary symptoms who've had some improvement of symptoms on treatment. I don't think that we've quantitated that in any of the two large randomized studies. In fact, thinking back to our study, we actually just put together our quality of life data, and there didn't seem to be a major difference in the urinary symptoms the quality of life component between taxotere and mitoxantrone. But in my own personal experience, we've had patients who have had improvements in local voiding symptoms.
What about bone pain?
In both studies, there was improvement in bone pain. It was more pronounced in the TAX-327 study, where there was significant improvement in bone pain compared to mitoxantrone and prednisone. We didn't see it in the SWOG study, but in the SWOG study, the experimental arm did not have prednisone. So it's a little bit of an unfair comparison, but nonetheless, there is a better palliation of bone pain with docetaxel plus prednisone versus mitoxantrone plus prednisone.
In patients who actually have measurable disease, how often do you see objective tumor shrinkage?
In the SWOG study and the TAX-327 study, it was about 15%, somewhere in that range. It was a little bit lower than what we had seen in our phase 2 experience, but we do see objective responses.
Judd, another interesting aspect of this case was the fact that he had PSA progression on an LHRH agonist, which then, if I understand correctly, decreased when bicalutamide was added. How often do you see that, and what do you think the implications are?
Again, I didn't want to comment on the further advanced disease. That's Dan's territory. But earlier on, I would have argued that, and this happens a lot, I think they treated the LHRH and the oral antiandrogen backwards. If you look at the literature would more strongly support using MAB up front, using the LHRH and the oral antiandrogen at the start, and then withdrawing the oral antiandrogen when the patient progressed. In this case, they used the LHRH at the beginning and added the antiandrogen when he progressed. A lot of urologists do that, and a lot of urologists particularly did that in the era thinking about cost containment. They said, well, I didn't want to subject the patient to the added cost of the pills. I'm going to hold the pills in the back pocket till the patient progresses. But if you look at the data on objective progression rates, it's better off to use it up front and then pull it away to save your money later. Now, you will get PSA responses that are typically transient and occasional clinical responses of just cranking back in oral antiandrogens or high-dose Casodex or nalutamide. And in fact, I think Dan's published on nalutamide, and they're useful. But again, my argument would be, if you're going to use CAB, use it up front and then pull the antiandrogen away when the guy fails.
I think that we all use secondary hormonal manipulations in this setting, and my favorite's always been Nizoral and cortisone. So generally, I agree with Judd that I usually use maximal blockade up front and then either change antiandrogens or add Nizoral and cortisone. Generally, those work about 20.
What dose?
With Nizoral, I go with a stepwise approach. I'll start at 200 TID. If they tolerate it, then I'll increase it and add cortisone.
How much cortisone?
20 BID. In some diabetic patients, I don't add the cortisone. I'll just go with the low-dose Nizoral and then switch them over to something different after that. I found that sometimes we have some trouble controlling the diabetes with the cortisone on board. So I think that this case is interesting from the standpoint that, you know, when is the optimal time to administer chemotherapy in these patients? Clearly, in this case, they gave the chemotherapy when the patient was symptomatic. Is it better to give Taxotere earlier? Can you get a better response with these patients? We really don't know the answer to this question. I guess the best way to think about this is an analogy to baseball. You can use your best pitcher in the first couple of innings of the game and then move other pitchers in as needed, or save your best pitcher for later and try more experimental approaches to begin with. And particularly with the implementation of vaccine therapy and dendritic cell therapy, where we're seeing some very interesting data in the asymptomatic patient who's hormone refractory or PSA rises. I think that we have a lot of work to do as to how we should best integrate chemotherapy with immune therapy or other novel agents.
Can you talk a little bit more about the vaccines that have been developed, what they are, and what we know about them?
There are at least three approaches that are being taken at this particular point. GVAX, which is a combination of the human prostate cancer cell lines, LNCAP and PC3. These are both made replicationally incompetent and transduced with GM-CSF, injected into patients. And interestingly, there are PSA responses that have been seen with this. And in a small phase 2 study, median survival about 23 months. There are two trials that GVAX is being evaluated in prostate cancer. The first is called VITAL-1, which is a randomized trial in asymptomatic patients of GVAX versus Taxotere. The second trial is VITAL-2, which Taxotere is being combined with GVAX, so it's GVAX plus Taxotere versus Taxotere alone, and that's for symptomatic patients. There's been a lot of exciting data about dendritic cells in hormone-refractory prostate cancer. There have been two randomized trials in asymptomatic patients, metastatic disease, rising PSA, of Seplucil, that's otherwise known as Provenge, versus placebo. And again, in these small studies, there is a survival benefit which is significant. And a lot of people have met these studies with skepticism because of their size, because of the fact that some of the endpoints have changed over time. But when you critically look at this data, you look at the number of patients who've had previous chemotherapy, you analyze the data for prognostic factors, I clearly think that there's a signal there. So I think that there's a third randomized trial which is being done with Provenge. The data from that should be available in a couple of years, and I understand that the company's going to file for approval in 2007. Then the third one is to use a Fallopox vaccine, which is an anti-PSA vaccine. This is being done by the Therion Corporation, and there's been a randomized trial of vaccine versus placebo, again, in asymptomatic hormone-refractory prostate cancer patients.
I assume we have no results from that?
There aren't any results back from that. There is preclinical data that also suggests that there may be synergy between chemotherapy and these immune therapy approaches. So I can envision a day in the next 5 to 10 years where we'll be giving immune therapy first, then followed by chemotherapy, again, to maximize the interaction between the two different modalities. I've treated a 92-year-old with chemotherapy, and he's lived 3 years, and he had a good quality of life. Remember that that two-month difference is a little bit misleading because it's a 20 to 24% overall improvement in survival. And in the Taxotere 27 study, at 3 years, you're starting to see a flattening of that curve. So I think that every patient really should be offered this. It's up to them to decide whether it's appropriate for them. But I think that the toxicities and the complication rates compared to what we were talking about with the androgen blockade before, that's a drop in the bucket compared to what that patient was going through. And if they're properly managed, if the oncologist is experienced in giving the treatments and knows when to push and when not to push, I think the patient certainly can benefit from it.
I just try to put myself in the position of a urologist, and it is kind of a black box. You know, maybe you kind of don't trust exactly what's going to happen once the patient gets to an oncologist. How many patients, once they go through chemo, turn around and say, well, I'm glad I went through it, and maybe made me feel better if I didn't feel better to start with? It's very hard to assess that by seeing data presented.
Judd? We're in an academic setting where we do have a multidisciplinary approach, but the good news, bad news for the patients that get into that multidisciplinary clinic, it's, I think, a tremendous benefit to the patients. The problem is that not all patients can access that clinic because it's expensive, for one thing. It is, from a cost standpoint, it's difficult to do a multidisciplinary clinic because, just take the practical issue of a urologist. If I put one of my faculty members in a multidisciplinary clinic for a half day and see six patients, from a pure revenue standpoint, it's difficult to justify that as opposed to having that person in the operating room. But on the other hand, it's an extremely valuable thing for the patients. I think it's the right thing to do, but in the practical sense, the way our healthcare system is structured, there are challenges to that model in the real world setting of multidisciplinary clinics.
So actually, we've sort of straddled the fence with that, and we've overcome that by having our clinics all jointly done in the same space. So this way, there can be cross-fertilization. Mm. You can generate your income at the same time. But no, you're absolutely right. We need a better approach, and I think that oncologists do need to be educated in how to take care of prostate cancer. When I look back at the data from SWOG 9916, our greatest problem with eligibility came from lack of adequate anti-androgen withdrawal. They think it's exactly the same tumor as breast cancer. It's not. You have to do things sequentially. So I think that there does need to be trials about early versus delayed chemotherapy. I mean, I think that would answer one of your questions. I think that some oncologists have the perception that earlier chemotherapy is not better, and I think we need data to dispel that.
To me, one of the things that bothers me the most about this association between the oncologist and the urologist is I don't think things are getting done fast enough in terms of clinical research. A lot of men are dying of prostate cancer. Many, many more are suffering. A lot of it has to do with the treatments. I just don't see things getting done fast enough. And I just wonder if the oncologists were more involved, whether or not the research aspect would get kicked up a bit. Judd, any thoughts?
Probably would. Again, on one hand, I think that it's critical for urologists to be key players in prostate cancer. Early stage prostate cancer is our bread and butter, and that's something that we need to maintain our heavy key involvement with. But I do agree that if we had a better multidisciplinary approach in advanced prostate cancer, medical oncologists are trained and radiation oncologists are trained better in clinical trial methodology than we are. And so it would be better. Now, at our place, I can tell you we're one of the few urology programs in the country that has two medical oncologists who are actually working in urology, in the Department of Surgery and Urology. It's a wonderful experience. And our clinical trial output has improved dramatically with having those guys as part of the true departmental team.
Now, I'd like to actually go on to Dr. Tripp's patient.
Mr. A presented to me close to 6 years ago as a 71-year-old with a PSA of 18.1. This was worrisome initially because a previous PSA the year prior was 5.0 at his internist's office, an exam. He did have an abnormal digital rectal exam with a very indurated right lobe and a very nodular left lobe, essentially abnormality of both lobes of the prostate. He was otherwise just a very anxious gentleman who had a strong desire to find out what was going on and to go ahead and get a diagnosis. We did a transrectal ultrasound and biopsy. There were 12 biopsies done with an additional one of an abnormal hypoechoic area that was more abnormal than the others on the right side. And the biopsy showed 9 out of 13 cores positive, Gleason grade 6 to 7. Most of the cores were involved with cancer, 85% of most of the cores. So when it was positive, it was mostly positive. And at that time, a bone scan and a CAT scan were performed as well, and that was normal.
Can you talk a little bit more about this man, what his lifestyle was like at that point?
He was quite accomplished, quite successful in life, had an excellent quality of life. He was an avid tennis player. He was sexually active. He was really on no medications. He had no medical problems. And he had been through a lot, obviously, as a child. He survived the Holocaust, and it seemed like there was nothing that was going to bring him down or that would affect him.
Judd, can you talk a little bit how you would think through management of this patient?
Well, this is a very interesting case, and something we don't see as much of in 2006 as we did 5 or 6 years ago just because of the stage migration. But man had a PSA of 18 at age 71. He had a big-time PSA velocity in the year before diagnosis. Now, 5 or 6 years ago, we didn't know that that was important. But now, looking at it today, the fact that he went from 5 to 18 and had a bad doubling time would be a poor prognostic factor. Probably clinical T2B/T2C disease, although when you look at 9 of 13 positive cores with 85% involvement, realistically, the guy probably had T3 disease and negative metastatic workup. And you're left with the famous B2C prostate cancer in a 71-year-old man, and then you have to make the decision between surgery or radiation or multimodality therapy.
In general, how would you approach a patient like this?
He's a healthy individual, no other comorbidities. You know, as a good old American urologist, my favored initial approach would be radical prostatectomy, if I'm completely honest with myself, and if it was my father and he asked me what to do. However, in fairness to our colleagues in radiation oncology, he is over 70. He does have probably locally advanced disease. And certainly, I suspect if this gentleman's father or son was a radiation oncologist or daughter was a radiation oncologist, they would probably lean towards a combination of external beam along with, say, 2 to 3 years of hormonal therapy. I know that brachytherapy is popular throughout the United States. What role brachytherapy would play in this individual with external beam is a completely controversial topic, but that certainly, at least in completeness, would need to be mentioned because I suspect some urologists would favor maybe a combination of external beam and seeds to try to crank up the dose along with some form of hormonal therapy for a period of time.
Dan?
Looking at this patient, he's an active, vigorous, healthy man. He's playing tennis. He's had a rapid increase in his PSA velocity. And this is somebody who I think is going to eventually get into trouble, because his lifespan may be another 10 or 15 years. And we often have patients come into us with this dilemma. How do you approach what is a potentially high-risk patient? And the way I present it to them is that, as Judd had said, this patient probably is a T3 based upon his other parameters. And the one way to conclusively stage this patient is to go forth with a radical prostatectomy, with the caveat that this patient would strongly consider a high-risk adjuvant protocol post-surgery, such as SWOG-9921, which is a randomized trial of 2 years of hormones versus 2 years of hormones plus mitoxantrone and prednisone. That's not available to him if he undergoes radiation therapy, at least at our institution.
What's the eligibility of that SWOG study?
This is for patients who have a Gleason 7 plus extraprostatic extension, Gleason's 8, 9, or 10, or node-positive disease.
So, Dr. Tripp, can you follow up with what happened with the patient?
The treatment that satisfied the patient and myself with regards to active treatment and allowing him potentially active sexual functioning, which was important to him, was both external beam and IMRT and a boost with the seed implant, 4,500 rads in 25 treatments with IMRT, and then followed by a seed implant. This was given with Casodex initial therapy and Lupron therapy as well. Also, at that point, a discussion was undertaken with him with regards to how long the hormone treatment would be given. And at that point, a decision was made, at least initially, to give him a total of 3 years of hormonal therapy. The first year was given with Lupron, and then we changed it to Casodex monotherapy for the last 2 years.
Can you talk about sort of what the difference was in his quality of life in the first year versus the second 2 years?
To the patient, it was a huge difference. There was a weight gain of approximately 25 to 30 pounds, and this is with him being warned and dieting and exercising. His exercise tolerance was severely impaired. His sexual function was nil. His sexual interest was nil. And he really did have a tough year, depression-wise, anxiety-wise, and a change in his life with regards to all of these issues. We changed him after 1 year to Casodex, and remarkably, within about 3 months, initially within a couple of months, he found a change. But within about 3 or 4 months, he really had a shedding of his weight. His energy level was better. His sense of well-being was better. And his sexual functioning was much better. So for him, the quality of life was dramatic.
What about his breasts?
His breasts, within about 2 to 3 months, was a real issue on the Casodex monotherapy, both the breast size and the breast tenderness. And prophylactic radiation therapy to the breast was discussed with the patient, but it really wasn't pushed, and he opted not to have that done. So we initially treated him with tamoxifen, which helped, but within a month, his breast tenderness and size was really not that responsive to tamoxifen, so he received external beam after approximately 3 months of monotherapy, and it actually responded quite well, although his size is still about the same size. The tenderness and the increasing of the size stopped. So it was a very nice response for him.
How was the bicalutamide 150 paid for? Did he pay out of pocket?
That was a real issue, and he did pay. The original 3 months was tough, but one of the reasons we were able to do it was the insurance company did pay almost all of it for the course, and that was an important consideration from beginning to end.
Dan, what are your thoughts in terms of this case at this point?
I think that this patient is manifesting the typical types of side effects that we see with androgen blockade, and I think this is going to become more of an important problem as we start identifying these high-risk patients. Weight gain is a significant problem, loss of muscle mass, and one of the things that we are very aggressive about counseling our patients is making sure that they maintain an exercise program, watch their weight. Mark Moyad once quoted a statistic, for a normal male to lose 1 pound, you have to burn 3,500 calories. It's 4,500 calories for a patient who's on androgen blockade. So it's about a little less than a third more calories that you have to lose or burn to lose a pound. I think also the other problems that we do identify with androgen blockade include osteoporosis.
Did this man have a bone density, incidentally, Dr. Tripp?
No, he did not.
That also is a significant problem, and we generally will measure bone mineral density on a yearly basis on our patients.
Who are on LHRH agonists?
Right, who are on LHRH. I know from the Medicare database that Matt Smith analyzed that a significant proportion of patients will begin to lose bone mineral density, and androgen blockade is the single most important prognostic factor towards developing osteoporosis.
Are there patients on whom you start bisphosphonates?
Yes. Yes, we do.
What about the bicalutamide? What's been seen in terms of bone there?
Well, that's probably a little bit of a different situation. I would like to know if this patient's testosterone rebounded once.
It did.
Yeah. So that is probably the most important factor in maintaining your bone mineral density. And there have been some other reports about single-agent bicalutamide where you don't have as much bone loss in that particular situation because you do have testosterone on board.
Judd, what are your thoughts about this case? A little bit of an unusual twist there. I remember when you were with the military, you were prescribing bicalutamide monotherapy because it was covered. I'm curious now that you're out in the real world what your thoughts are about this and what your thoughts are about this unusual strategy that was used.
Well, first off, I want to applaud Dr. Tripp and his colleagues because they did employ a multimodality approach to this high-risk patient. He was treated similar, it's a kind of a twist on the Ebola trial where the guy got radiation, albeit as opposed to just external beam in the modern era, his local dose was increased with the implant. And then a la Ebola, he would have gotten quote unquote 3 years of hormonal therapy, but this guy, you adjusted it nicely to try to improve his quality of life. In the issue of the Casodex 150, yeah, it's interesting. In the military, I got brownie points, if you will, from the administration, because when you think about it, military VA setting, LHRH costs are fixed for the healthcare system. There's no benefit to the physicians. Oral hormonal therapy costs are fixed. And the reality was, if I put an advanced prostate cancer patient on oral-only hormonal therapy, say bicalutamide 150, the cost to our healthcare system were actually less than the cost of complete hormonal therapy or either LHRH alone. So from that standpoint, I was getting attaboys for saving money for the system. Obviously, in the real world, things are completely turned around. I will say that after January 1st, 2006, with the introduction of Medicare Part D, I have had a number of patients who now would at least consider an oral approach, especially if they've signed up for Medicare Part D and their out-of-pocket costs will be less. You know, the $64,000 question in this case would be, was the 1 year of LHRH therapy adequate? Is the Casodex 150 the right dose? Should it have been 50 milligrams? Could you have used lower dose Casodex with finasteride or dutasteride, which are all unproven strategies? The classic teaching on the breast issue is that, just like with the DES days of old, the best results were that when you gave prophylactic breast irradiation before you even started the therapy, and you guys offered that and the patient declined. And I was very intrigued by the fact that he did get some response to the tenderness and the fact that it didn't progress after you gave him the beam radiation, although the gynecomastia itself didn't go away. In the military, I treated a number of men with Casodex 150 who were very body conscious, retired generals, and these men who were the STRAC military guys. And the gynecomastia was an issue. And one thing that could also be done would be a subcutaneous mastectomy in this case, and plastic surgeons could do it almost percutaneously, like in a liposuction manner.
Clearly, the treatment that was given does not correspond to what was done in the Ebola trial, which is kind of given the standard of care. And yet, we know there's a little bit of a halo around the standard of care that physicians always consider. And there's often not a right and wrong answer. It's really a judgment call. I'm curious, Dan, what your thoughts are about the strategy that was used here. Do you consider it within the realm of standard of care?
I think it is within the realm of standard of care because, remember, this patient was having severe difficulty after his first year. And obviously you want to cure the patient. That's the first priority. But also you want to have a reasonable quality of life. And we have a lot of men who really have severe difficulty tolerating hormonal therapy. And the loss of testosterone makes a huge difference in their mental outlook as well as their physical appearance. And I think that both of those feed into each other. So given the fact that this patient could not tolerate androgen blockade, I think that it was within the realm of reason to try the next best step, which was to do peripheral blockade with Casodex rather than to continue on combined blockade.
Judd, where are we right now in terms of potential adverse effects of bicalutamide monotherapy? There was a report that came out a couple of years ago. I think you actually were the one who reviewed the paper, if I remember correctly, that you had told me. Where are we right now in terms of understanding whether there is actually a non-prostate cancer adverse effect of this therapy?
The big concern, just to cut right to the chase, is that if one uses Casodex 150 in lower risk or clinically localized prostate cancer, the Scandinavian arm of the big trial would suggest there was an excess mortality rate in men who got the Casodex 150 versus placebo. Now, that was only in localized disease in men who were otherwise on watchful waiting. The counter is that the men who had high-risk disease features or locally advanced disease actually had a survival benefit from Casodex 150, similar to more traditional hormonal therapy. And so it's difficult now to know where to position the use of the drug with that data. This gentleman, if you say that he is locally advanced and extrapolate that data, you would say it's safe to use Casodex 150. Let's say it was reversed and this guy had much lower features, and let's say he was just on watchful waiting and didn't want anything done, but you were just going to quote-unquote add in Casodex 150 just as a little insurance policy, that would be definitely verboten, I think, with this latest data. So if localized disease, truly localized disease, lower risk disease, I would be a little bit reluctant to use it right now until that data gets more clarified. You ask about the standard of care. American Urologic Association right now is updating their guidelines for the management of localized prostate cancer. It's an update of previous guidelines that were written in 1995. And it's been a real challenging process because, as we all know, the literature still leaves a lot to be desired in this area. But they are writing the guidelines based on either standards, recommendations, or options. So in localized prostate cancer, the AUA is taking the stance that if it's going to be called a standard or like a standard of care, it pretty much has to be based on randomized controlled data. Recommendations, obviously, are a little bit lower down the food chain and maybe based on expert opinion or other non-randomized data or even randomized data from small studies. And then options are things that people can do which are reasonable but don't have as much data. And I would say, certainly in this case, taking it from the beginning, the external beam plus the implant would be an option. There's really nothing hardly in this case where you would say it was a standard unless he was treated exactly like bolus. And that's where it's confusing. I mean, you can say a standard of care is some form of hormone therapy with high-risk individuals along with external beam, but yet this is a twist on that. So I'm not sure if you can say it's a standard of care.
It might be a little bit of a semantic issue because standard of care implies that's what you ought to do. That's fascinating. I guess what would be really interesting is what's not on the list. So if it's not on one of those three, you might imply that it's not something that's evidence-based.
Well, one thing that's interesting about this case, he was treated with brachytherapy. And technically, when you look at his features, this man falls into the D'Amico intermediate risk category because his PSA was still less than 20. He had Gleason 6 and 7, so he doesn't fall into the high risk. From a pure academic standpoint, let's say he was high risk. Let's say his PSA was greater than 20 or had Gleason 8 or 9. Some in the field may have criticized you by using brachytherapy in that setting. Brachytherapy is still cool if it's intermediate risk, but when you go to high risk, there's some experts who say, well, if it's high risk, forget the seeds. Although, again, it's controversial.
I was just very impressed with his quality of life improvements and with the outcome of the treatment, with the changing of the total androgen blockade to Casodex 150 milligram daily dose. It was a very impressive response, and I think it was very important to the patient. And then, interestingly to me, that when the patient presented several years ago, there was really no consensus on combination therapy of IMRT and seed implant, and there was definitely no consensus and there was no comment on Casodex monotherapy. So when this was done, it was actually an easier decision for me to make then because there was less known as far as the New England Journal article that Scardino had put out with regards to combination therapy and the article that you're referring to with regards to Casodex monotherapy. So I didn't have to cross that bridge at that time because I was being more aggressive from a combination therapy point of view. And from the Casodex point of view, it was a way of giving him total androgen blockade in a way that improved his quality of life. And it's interesting that now I would probably have more of a difficult decision, although I would probably do the exact same thing.
Dan, what do we know about potential cardiovascular issues with androgen deprivation in terms of less exercise, gaining weight, potentially contributing to increased cardiac morbidity?
Well, there have been some studies looking at increased risk of diabetes mellitus with hormone blockade. It only makes sense if you're going to put weight on, you're going to be at a higher risk of developing type 2 diabetes. There have been issues also with hormone therapy by prolongation of the QT interval, which may predispose to cardiac arrhythmias. So I think all of these considerations must be made in whether you're going to place a patient on androgen blockade or not.
So Dr. Tripp, I'd like you to follow up to the present time with this patient.
Well, this patient has been off androgens for close to 2 years, and after 6 months, his PSA was noted to be 0.3. And just now, his last PSA was actually 0.58, which I guess is 0.6. And we're at the point, at least with discussion with him, on trying to find out what his true baseline is after hormonal ablation and after radiation therapy, because we never really had an opportunity to see what his real baseline is. But at this time, he's doing very well from a quality of life point of view. Just had his 50th anniversary. Took all his children on a cruise, and he's doing great. So we'll see where his baseline ends up.
Yeah, just taking a step back, thinking about this man as a teenager in the Holocaust, to survive, to be married 50 years, and now dealing with prostate cancer. What a story. Judd, any thoughts about where he's at right now?
His PSA of 0.6, you can argue that two ways. You could argue that if he had been a radical prostatectomy patient with a PSA of 0.6, we would already had given him the talk about recurrence, because at 0.6 after surgery, that would have not been a good thing. However, obviously, with the combination seeds and external beam, his prostate gland is still in situ. And depending on who you read, that PSA may be normal or it may be abnormal. Frank Kreitz, who's the guy in Atlanta who has the radiotherapy clinics of Georgia, where they do beam seeds on everybody. In fact, they coined the term prostacision. Kreitz would take the approach that if a guy has a PSA greater than 0.2 in long-term follow-up, he's going to fail if he has a PSA above 0.2 after beam and seeds. On the other hand, taking a practical approach, the guy's doing fine. If he's not a PSA addict, not worried about his PSA, he probably will die of something else, we hope. And the only fear is that if he's a PSA addict or really freaking out about his PSAs, his quality of life might be affected by worrying so much about the PSA not being lower.
Dan, what would it take for you to strongly suggest hormonal therapy just based on PSA in this man?
Well, I think that I would look at the PSA doubling time. I think that that's really the decision point that we're using to place patients on therapy. If it's slowly rising PSA with a doubling time of greater than 10 months, that's somebody who you're going to watch. If it starts getting to be less than 10 months, I think you need to take the entire patient into consideration, what their overall lifespan is going to be, what the effect of the hormone therapy is going to be, and that's one of my trigger points. Saying that, I think we really do need a randomized trial at this point in the patient with an asymptomatic doubling time as to what we should start. Should it be hormone therapy? Should it be chemotherapy? Should it be some combination thereof or some sequence thereof? We still don't have the right answers.
What trials are looking at that right now, particularly the issue of chemotherapy and PSA-only disease?
There's a randomized trial that's being run by Mike Morris from Memorial Sloan Kettering. And what they're doing is they're taking the patients with, I believe, a doubling time of less than 3 months. That may not be the exact doubling time. It's maybe 3 months, it may be 10 months. And they're being randomized to combine blockade plus or minus Taxotere. Now, it's an interesting trial and certainly needs to be done, but I think we still have a lot of unanswered questions as to what the proper sequence should be with hormone therapy and chemotherapy. I think that we still have some questions as to the optimal sequencing, and I think these are questions that need to be answered clinically as well as preclinically.
You know, it's interesting that issue of short-term chemo followed by long-term hormone is what eventually has evolved in breast cancer. You know, that's basically what most women with breast cancer receive as therapy. Dr. Tripp, if you got to the point, again, PSA-only disease with this man that you were really concerned, felt like he really needed to have therapy initiated, what kind of hormone therapy do you think he'd utilize?
I definitely think that I would use Casodex 150 milligrams daily, and that would obviously be the decision between the patient and myself with the discussion of the results of the higher mortality with 150 milligrams, even though we can't explain why, but I do have that discussion with my patients when I do treat them with Casodex monotherapy.
Just out of curiosity, because I think a trial like the one that was just described where it's a therapy plus or minus chemo is always a challenge to see whether a patient would be willing to go on the study. If you had that trial available and participating, do you think that this man would be interested or willing to?
Absolutely.
Really?
Oh yeah, no question. He has a strong desire to beat the cancer. And I think patients like him would do that very often. I think that would not be a hard sell to give chemotherapy short-term, the same approach that you have for breast cancer, if that's the approach that might help him.
Just based on the majority of my patients, most of them would say no at first, and then as soon as they saw that their PSA was starting to go up, that's when they would be a little bit more concerned. If they had 0.6, they might not do anything. If they went to 0.8, they might not do anything. But if all of a sudden their next PSA comes back 3 or 4, I think that's when they're going to start to get more interested in having some type of treatment.
Do you think trials like this are going to get done, Judd? I mean, it's really frustrating to look at the lack of data that we have in prostate cancer.
It is frustrating, and I think a lot of it's more of a system problem than a patient problem. I mean, if we take the time to explain a lot of these trials to the patients and they get the consent forms and get referred to the right people, a lot of the patients are willing to go on the trials. In fact, Dan talked about 9921, which is the post-radical prostatectomy adjuvant trial. That actually, I had no trouble getting patients to go on that trial. But the problem is that when I switched institutions, I was in a different healthcare system, which was more financially driven. There was less resources to get those patients on trials, less support for me as a urologist to push that trial. And in the private sector, the challenges are there's a growing shortage of urologists. Everyone's working harder for less. And the frustration is, I think we all believe in clinical trials, but in the practical sense, it's difficult when we have large patient volumes and don't have the support we need. I don't have the solution. But again, bottom line, it's more of a systems problem than it is a doctor-patient problem.
Dan, can you kind of put in perspective what a patient would go through who gets randomized in this study to receive the docetaxel compared to, say, what a breast cancer patient goes through who gets typical adjuvant chemotherapy?
Well, I think now the difference is that it's either chemotherapy or no chemotherapy. We're a breast cancer patient. It's more of a selection process as to what type of chemotherapy they're going to get. So I think that fundamentally it makes it a little bit more difficult for a patient to enter in this type of trial because you're getting less therapy. You may be getting a more refined therapy in a breast cancer trial because they've had 15 or 20 years to develop these particular systems. What I think the difficulty is now is a patient has options to go elsewhere. I basically tell the patient that this is the standard of care, and the way that I will treat you is on a study for chemotherapy. Some will say, well, thank you very much. I want chemotherapy, and I'll go somewhere else and get it. The crucial thing is to offer patients drugs that they can't get outside of a clinical trial setting. That's where the vaccines come in. That's where some of the newer chemotherapeutic agents come in. That's where I think we'll begin to see our big differences in studies. Because if the only way a patient can receive a vaccine or dendritic cells or new chemotherapeutic agents is through this type of randomized mechanism, that's the way they'll get it. There's an analogy to this. In 1987, there was a randomized trial that was opened in the Southwest Oncology Group of cystectomy plus or minus MVAC chemotherapy. That trial took about 10 or 12 years to accrue its patients. The reason was you could get that treatment anywhere else. If the urologist or the oncologist believed in the chemotherapy, they got it off protocol. If they didn't believe in it, they got the cystectomy and they received adjuvant treatment. If there were a novel agent that were incorporated into that particular design, then the patient has a motivation to go on that particular study. They get something new, potentially something sexy.
And certainly in a lot of tumors right now, really breast, lung, and colon, we're seeing the chemotherapy plus or minus bevacizumab or Avastin trials, which really fit into that. That's basically the only way you can get it. But just, again, kind of going back to quality of life, hoping that we are going to be able to get this trial done, hoping that it is positive, what would you say to somebody who's going to go through six cycles of docetaxel compared to, say, for example, in breast cancer, node negative patient, 10 or 20% chance of developing recurrence? Almost all those women will get four cycles of adriamycin, cyclophosphamide. How would you compare quality of life with the two?
I think the quality of life with a single agent is certainly better. You're not looking at a multi-drug treatment in this particular setting. You're not looking at two drugs or three drugs. So certainly the quality of life, and we've seen with patients who've been on adjuvant chemotherapy studies, has been very, very acceptable. You do get some side effects. I think the impression that a lot of us have is that it's easier to get full dosages of drug in to a patient who has non-metastatic disease than a patient who's more advanced and has other comorbidities, other signs and symptoms of their cancer. So for the most part, in just thinking about the patients I've treated, it's been very, very well tolerated. I don't recall any patients have come off study because they could not tolerate the toxicities.